Talks with.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The great American middle class came of age in the years following World War II. Jobs were plentiful and they paid well, and the middle class was welcoming. People from lower socioeconomic groups were able to enter the middle class, moving up the economic ladder and improve their lives. If it is true that a rising tide raises all boats, then it can be argued that the comfortable middle class helped build the economy of this country. They made money, so they spent money on houses, cars, college educations, and other goods and services. But then something happened. Wages stagnated, job security became uncertain, prices rose, debt increased, and income disparity widened enormously. All of this conspired to put the brakes on upward mobility and threatens the viability of the middle class. Our guest today says the middle class is in serious trouble. He and his co-author, Kevin Light, have written about it extensively in their book, Middle Class Meltdown in America: Causes, Consequences, and Remedies. Dr. Scott Fitzgerald is an associate professor and director of graduate studies in the Department of Sociology at UNC Charlotte, and he spends the hour with us talking about his findings and hopefully his remedies. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Economist Robert Reich has spoken at length about this. Mother Jones magazine has written about this, as have other publications reported about the decline of the middle class. Now along comes your book, the result of a decade that you have spent researching what's happening to the middle class. Is anyone listening?
Well, I think there are more and more people listening. And really, since 2008, 2009, when we had the collapse of global finance and the housing market, people began to sort of wake up a bit to the realities of the economic situation that we're facing. And I think part of the result of those changes, we saw the emergence of the Occupy movement and other protesters who were bringing attention to the issues of economic inequality. And I think the coverage of that started to reach more and more people. And I think also as more and more Americans faced these economic hardships, and there was more discussion of why this was happening, we became increasingly aware that something had to change. And I think particularly right now what we see is a growing attention to economic inequality, which is clearly a related concept to thinking about the middle class meltdown.
You know, it's easy to think of this as a left-right issue, where people on the left would say, well, everybody has to have a fair salary and everybody, you know, we have to have an even playing field. People on the right say, no, you work for your money, you get ahead. If you don't get ahead, that's your fault, okay? That's the extremes of those things. But truly, it's not a left-right issue, is it? We're all in this together. It seems to me that given the role that the middle class plays, if we live in a consumer economy, which we do, if you don't have any money, you can't buy anything and the economy stops. So why hasn't somebody done something about this? It's in their best interest. The people who have the money, the big companies who run things, it seems to me it's in their best interest to make sure that their workers are paid a fair wage so they can buy – Henry Ford knew this – so they can buy the products that they make.
Precisely. And I think that is really the crux of the matter, is that the U.S. economy is based on consumer spending, and that means middle class spending. And we've seen that back going from the 1930s onward through our prosperous years in the 50s and 60s. And what we see is that capitalism works when workers have the money to spend, which will force businesses, will provide opportunities for businesses to hire more workers to produce more products.
So you're not an economist, you're a sociologist. So when you look at this long term through a sociological lens, has this happened before? Is this one of those things where the pendulum just kind of goes out of whack a little bit and then swings back because it has to?
Well, there are multiple people who make the argument that this is sort of a natural progression of capitalism and the pendulum will swing. And I actually recently heard Robert Reich speak, and he was saying essentially the same thing, that there is an opportunity for the government and others to step in to help regulate capitalism in a way that can help bring it back in line. And I think part of that is recognizing that markets aren't bad. Markets do a lot of things really well. And in fact, the solid middle class that we've had for so long is the product of market economies. And so the question is not whether or not we should have markets. The question is, how should the rewards from that market activity be distributed. And I don't mean distributed in the sense of a redistributed after the fact in terms of government intervention, so getting into classic political debates of how this happens, but more importantly, thinking about how companies and how those who are generating profits are reinvesting or those productivity gains. And what we saw in the 80s and in the 90s was a situation which was somewhat unheard of, that during this time period, we saw dramatic rises in productivity. And all economic theories will essentially say the same thing. That is, if your productivity is rising, all else equal, that means profits are rising. And so the question became, what happened to those profits? And so what we see is that during the same period that workers' wages remained stagnant, they essentially were flatlined.
Because doesn't increasing productivity mean that you're doing more with less?
That is precisely what it means. And so when that happens, firms have multiple choices what to do with that money. What we saw was an increase in wages at the top. We saw an increase in merger and acquisition activity and other revenue generating actions that did not produce products or produce wage increases for the workers.
You know, my father worked for the same company his entire life, and there seemed to be an unspoken loyalty between employees and their companies and their companies and their employees. If you do a good job, you stay here forever, you get your pension and your gold watch at 65, and off you are into the merry sunset. Was that a mirage? Did that really ever exist? Because loyalty seems to be gone today.
Right. I don't think it was a mirage. Sometimes I think we tend to over-romanticize what it was, but I think there's a very strong storyline. If we look back in the post-World War II era, is that there were what we could call sort of the middle class rules, mm-hmm. And sort of these assumptions of what it meant to be solidly middle class in the U.S.
And where do those assumptions come from?
Well, I think it comes from a variety of places. Part of it is cultural understandings and sort of cultural held values of how things work. But it also, in many ways, was a product of the particular time and place that we were in the 1950s. And so the post-World War II boom provided it would almost have been impossible for the middle class not to thrive in the economic and political conditions.
You call it a mistake, I think. I probably have misquoted you here, but the middle class economy of the 1950s.
Not that the middle class prosperity
of the 50s and 60s was an accident. That's what you say.
Yeah. So mistake and accident are very different things.
Right. So explain that.
Right. So what I mean by that, Kevin and I mean by that, is that it was not – it was this combination of forces in terms of rebuilding the economy and the international system post-World War II when we had millions of GIs coming back and we had a housing boom and we had – government programs designed to get people into homes, which to this date we still use housing starts as an indicator of economic growth.
And we were the strongest economy in the world. We had no competitors.
Correct.
None.
Right. And so you add those all together. In a sense, it's the perfect storm in the good sense of creating conditions where economic vitality is almost certain.
And so that's what we think about when we think of America. When people say they want their country back, that's part of what they want back. They want that idealistic 1950s things where the middle class is prosperous, where they have the nice house and the nice car and the three kids, whatever it may be. And that is a post-World War II construction. We don't remember what came before World War II, which was the Great Depression. And prior to the Great Depression and during the Great Depression, life wasn't like this in America, was it?
No, I think you're correct. And so one of the things that we see, again, in that post-World War II era is that the idea of you could get a job and be hardworking and loyal and that'd be rewarded by your employer, that you could buy a home and settle down, you can invest in that. That'd be your nest egg, which you could then pass down to your children mm-hmm. later on, and that you could look forward to retiring in your 60s. You could save for rainy days so something came up. And so during the economic heydays of the 50s and 60s and even the early 70s, that wasn't just an illusion. That was actually happening for people. But then a series of things happened, particularly from the late 70s onwards, some of it intentional and some of it unintentional. And so some of the unintentional, more broad economic trends is we had increased globalization, which increased the competitiveness of producers from across the world, which affected obviously middle class, which affected the American economy. We had the reorganization of the workplace, and so we have increased use, increased downsizing of firms, of shifting responsibilities, just-in-time production, other things to make sort of the U.S. firms lean and mean, which had a devastating effect on workers and job security. And we also, during that time, had political changes and decisions which shifted how this played out. And so the deregulation of key industries, everything thinking about the airline industries, electrical, then lead into the finance industry,
broadcasting.
deregulation also then changed how the ways in which business was being done. We have a decline in union membership, and unions had a long history of providing an upward push on wages and job security. And so we have all of these trends going during the same time, which then essentially helped sort of tear apart this social contract, this idea that if you did this, that you would get this back.
Well, you can't help globalization. That's something you have no control over. But you can help and I think when you say some of these things were done deliberately, when you talk about deregulation, mm-hmm. that was meant to be a good thing. Did they see the unintended consequences of this going into it, or were they just focused on this is going to be good for business, to heck with the workers?
Well, I think that the situation of deregulation, what they saw going in, is always a complicated story, and that there's always different histories told about that. So there are those who would argue that we didn't see it coming, that it was designed to be if we lessen the restrictions of regulation, that would allow firms to be more competitive, and that would ultimately help consumers. Mm-hmm. There's also those who argued during the time who argued against the deregulation is that if we look at the history of deregulated industries, what we also see is that there is a perpetual tendency for firms to maximize profits. And by doing so, that can help firms and it can help shareholders and it can help powerful elites, but it doesn't necessarily help workers or the middle class.
Well, something also happened. We just go back to the CEO pay increasing and that you talked about earlier in this conversation. CEOs, I think, maybe this was never true either, worked with their employees in mind. I mean, if you did a good job, you'll rise up the ladder, you'll get more money, you'll retire, you'll have a pension, you'll have health care while you're here. CEOs today work for the shareholders, don't they?
They do. And one of the claims that
what changed?
Well, one of the claims that we hear repeatedly is that, particularly from those who are advocating for this type of CEO pay differential, is that the CEOs are providing value added to the companies and that what they are doing, that we need to offer these exorbitant salary packages in order to get the top talent. But we see comparatively that that's just not the case, that in other countries, Japan, for example, CEOs, the ratio to CEO to average worker pay is a fraction of what it is here today. But firms can be as efficient. And so going back to the question of how or what happened for that change, part of it is it increasingly became the pattern of CEO pay was set by CEOs and board of directors. And so essentially, they are able to set their own compensation package, which are not tied to their productivity.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of that because that's important, I think. Dr. Scott Fitzgerald, his book is called Middle Class Meltdown in America. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Dangerous Liaisons, a passionate, dramatic ballet from Sasha James with live music from cellist Ben Soli, October 9th through 11th at Knight Theater. Tickets at charlotteballet.org. And Audi of Charlotte presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. We are about to get our first toll road It appears the deal is done despite ongoing opposition. A private company is going to be building toll lanes on I-77, and they will have the right to operate them for 50 years. It's going to be a costly project, and we talked to the North Carolina Department of Transportation officials and the vice president of that private company building the lanes tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama is stepping up U.S. efforts to treat Ebola victims and contain its spread in West Africa, addressing the medical, social, and political threats posed by the widening epidemic.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scott Fitzgerald is with us. He's an associate professor and director of graduate studies in the Department of Sociology at UNC Charlotte. He and his co-author, Kevin Light, from I think the University of Iowa?
Correct.
What do you commute when you write these books? I've written a book called Middle Class Meltdown in America, Causes, Consequences, and Remedies. By the way, he's speaking on Thursday evening at 6:30 at UNC Charlotte Center City. It's open to the public. We'll have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. We're talking about the middle class. So let's talk about who these people are so that everybody knows that we're all on the same page. Nearly all Americans, all of us, I don't care how much money you make or don't make, all of us identify as being middle class. Are we deluded? if we all think we're middle class and we've seen our wages stagnate and our buying power decline and our debt rise and we've seen the inequality in pay between CEO and the average worker, which is enormous, why haven't we as a group of people had the political clout to make changes?
Well, I think when we—
We're the biggest bunch of people in the world.
We are, but we're also very divided. And so one of the things that happens when we look at the larger political process is we have essentially what we could call issue cocoons, where individuals who are politically active will identify particular issues which are their issues. And so it may be— about the environment. It may be about LGBT issues. It may be about gender inequality, all of which are important, valid issues. But what often happens is we then make political decisions based on our issue cocoons. Think about which candidate is speaking the particular talking points to our issues.
But is that something that we in the middle class, the non-political people, although we all have political points of view— but we're not politicians. Is that something that we are considering, or are we being told to consider that? Are we being fed red herrings to take our eyes off
right.
the ball, which is the economy and pay?
Well, I think there's a strong case to be made that we are being taught to take our eye off the ball, as you say, that we are missing the larger point of what unites us in terms of the shared importance of economic prosperity for all of us. And I think and sometimes that is done deliberately. I think there's political scientist Larry Bartles who wrote a book, Unequal Democracy, which is a fascinating book looking at media and ideology and understandings of different issues. And one of, I think, his most intriguing findings to me is this finding that gets at the importance of media consumption and political ideology. And so essentially he has data to show that when people are asked, self-identified conservatives and self-identified liberals, when asked about sort of basic facts about economic inequality in the United States, they have roughly comparable understandings in terms of the accuracy of their understandings of whether or not economic inequality exists. Mm-hmm. But as media consumption increases, the knowledge and accuracy of liberals' understanding of economic inequality goes up. For conservatives, it goes down dramatically. And part of the explanation of that is we have seen these changes in media, which I'm sure you're aware of over the last decades, mm-hmm. of soundbite politics has become the norm. We rarely are in situations where we have nuanced, thoughtful, complex discussions of things other than on shows like this. But in terms of the soundbites, that's what the messages people get. And we also know that with the proliferation of alternate media sources rather than just print news, so with online news, blogs, tweets, a variety of things, is that people tend to become even more narrow in the types of sources that they use. And so liberals will consume only liberal media, and conservatives will only consume conservative media. And so what that finding from Bartle's study shows is the power of the conservative media to change our understanding of what economic inequality is. So again, going back to what the finding was, is that as consumption of media increases, understanding and accuracy, an accurate understanding of economic issues goes down.
Because I saw, and I don't know what the source of this is, I looked at this on the internet yesterday. Mm-hmm. There is what people think income distribution should be like. And they don't think that rich people should not be rich. They think rich people should be rich, mm-hmm. and they would like to be in that category. Mm-hmm. And they see themselves as having the ability with hard work and breaks, et cetera, mm-hmm. to move into that category. Then there is the perception of what the reality is, which is not what the people would like. Mm-hmm. It's worse than what people would like.
Correct.
But then there's the reality of what reality is. And the reality of it is
it's far
worse,
yes.
than what we think the reality is.
Yeah, and that the understanding of the economic reality is a challenge because, you know, we know that 400 of the richest Americans have more wealth than 50% of the population. So 400 Americans have more wealth than 150 million Americans and that we know that, you know, 1% of Americans own 50% of the stocks, mutual funds, and bonds in the U.S. And so that discussion that has come up a bit and a bit more frequently of this notion of the 1% gets at some of that idea. But it also draws attention away to sort of just the broader questions of the distribution and the economic realities. I think going back to this question of us all identifying as middle class, which you're completely correct in that almost 90% in most will identify as middle class. So in the book and in our research, what we focus on is sort of looking at folks whose incomes between $40,000 and $80,000 a year, household incomes. Typically, these are upper or lower level managers, professionals. They attended and probably graduated from mm-hmm. college. And so the median family income in the U.S. is around $53,000. And what happens, I think, going back to this understanding of inequality, is if we all identify as middle class and we think about our own incomes and think of those as representing the middle class, if I'm making $140,000 a year and I think of myself as middle class, I don't really see the same sets of pressures and issues as that someone who's actually at the median income or slightly below. And so we also have, I think, just a misunderstanding of the extreme levels of inequality that we see today.
And if you make $53,000 a year, that's the median income. That means that's right in the middle of what people make. A lot more people make less, and a few more people make more, but then there are people who make gargantuanly amounts more. Can you live on $53,000 a year comfortably? Can you live a middle-class life if you have two kids and a wife or two kids and a husband? Mm-hmm. Can you live comfortably?
Well, I think part of it depends on where you live, and part of it obviously depends on the particular lifestyle that you have in terms of what that middle class lifestyle means, in terms of if you're a homeowner and to what extent your mortgage reflects what your income is. The realities are that it's a struggle and that we've seen increased costs in nearly all aspects of life, particularly with childcare. And I think the other important part of this puzzle, right? If we're stepping back from what's happened in the last few decades, mm-hmm. is that during the 80s and 90s, consumer spending pretty much stayed the same. The economy was growing. All indicators leading pretty much up until 2007, 2008 were saying that the U.S. economy is the strongest economy in the world. Everyone is doing well. But that was really sort of driven – our understanding of that was driven by an illusion, because what happened was wages were stagnant, and really two things happened. The first is that the gaps between our spending and our wages were predominantly filled by adding a second worker into the household. And so rather than having a one person one member of the family working, mm-hmm. we now had two. And because of gender discrimination, workplace and other changes, particularly what that meant was there was more opportunities for women to enter the labor market. And so much of the gap was made up by having two incomes. But what that also does is that it provides increased pressures on family in terms of childcare, in terms of costs for housing, in terms of education. And so what we see is those increases or the maintenance of the middle class lifestyle was put into a precarious position, because now all of the money from two incomes are going to try to sustain this.
But this is a market-driven economy, and there are probably a few people who would like to see it be more socialistic, but most people in America, middle-class people, would want this to be a market-based economy. Aren't these salaries being dictated by the marketplace? If the marketplace is a good thing and it sets things in equilibrium, or it balances itself out, if you make $53,000 a year and that's the average income, isn't that what the market will bear?
Well, I think part of it is we need to step back and think about what the market value of something is. And so in terms of economic theory, a person's labor is worth what they get paid for. And as you were saying, that's what the market pays for it. But that also, as in all economic theories, it has the caveat of all else equal. So that assumes that workers have complete information, are able to seek out those information. It assumes that the labor market process is not a social process, that it's not one in which individuals and firms have procedures in place in terms of applicant pools and hiring and options. And so if workers don't have other options and do not have a sort of a position at the table in terms of bargaining, there's not the opportunity for those wages to reflect what they're actually doing.
In the 50s and 60s, we didn't have this kind of income disparity. There were CEOs and major managers who made more money than the rank and file worker, but not that much more money when you come right down to it. They didn't make 380 times, which is what it is today, what their average worker makes. It didn't take the average worker more than a month in the 1950s to earn what a CEO earns in an hour, which is what it is today. Why did that happen? How did that happen? How do you justify that? Is it just because we have to get the best talent at the top? Because if that's true, when the best talent at the top making 380 times more than what the average worker makes fails, and we've seen in this town, mm-hmm. not only have certain people failed, but they've almost taken the company with them, there don't seem to be any repercussions. They ride off into the sunset with their golden parachutes, and they're still making millions.
Right. I think one of the major explanations of that was the shift to the way CEO compensation was decided. And so the increased importance of using board of directors and others who are concerned about the bottom line of the company in terms of generating revenue and dividend payments rather than the long-term health of a particular corporation or firm. And so what happens is we have CEOs and boards who have sort of an interlocking directorate. And so some will serve on the board of one firm and then another, and they'll be a part of this decision. And so there's
one,
this
one upward, hand washes the other.
Right. And so there's upward pressure. And that also the compensation packages are structured in ways that they're not tied to the performance.
But really, is this most businesses, is it really about making widgets anymore as opposed to making money? Because then you have people like Carl Icahn who come in, as he did at Family Dollar, and force the sale of the company. His stock price goes up. He makes a couple million dollars or more for a couple of weeks' work, sells his shares and walks away richer, while people go unemployed because of the company being sold.
Right. And I think our economy has moved away from making widgets in multiple ways. And so both the shift from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy that we saw through the 70s, 80s, so that now the majority of people are employed in service industries. So in that sense, we're not making things the way that we had. But also in the sense of people are rewarded and firms are rewarded for generating revenue. Not necessarily making anything. And so the merger and acquisition wave that we saw, much of that activity didn't actually increase productivity. But what it does is with each transaction that takes place, there's money coming off of the top of that, and that's generating profits, at least for some.
Well, I know you're not an economist. You're a sociologist. But this sounds like fool's gold to me. It sounds unsustainable to me. At some point, this is going to be like the real estate bubble, the house of cards that just suddenly poof. Collapses.
Right.
Has this happened before? Have people – well, obviously it has because the real estate boom was one of those examples. Is this an example of that?
Yeah, I think it is. And so Kevin and I started work in this area in about 2002. And during those first few years because I'm a political economist, a political sociologist, and so I'm interested in the ways in which the economy, the economic systems, the political systems, and the social systems interact. And so as I read more and more and was reading as many economists as I could, reading political historians, economic historians, and talking with experts every chance I could get, because as I got a better understanding of the different issues as when we see how they're interconnected, I kept coming back time and time again to this idea of a house of cards, that this just does not seem like it's sustainable, particularly looking at the housing crisis and sort of the ways in which the subprime mortgages were emerging and how consumer credit had become more and more available, easily available. And each time that I was able to sort of corner economists or others who had particular expertise in it, and I would sort of offer my pronouncement much like you did in terms of this looks like a house of cards, the answer almost always was, it is. And that was quite a disturbing.
Scary.
Yeah. Part of me was pleased that I was right in my assessment in terms of what they, but the other part, which gets to this notion of the marketing of an illusion, and that's what Kevin and I refer to throughout the book, is that part of what happens is our political discourse hides many of the realities, in that if someone questions the ways in which the profits and the rewards from market activity are being distributed, it immediately falls into sort of classic name calling and sort of, okay, that's socialism, that's communism, or that's capitalism, and that it's in terms of these old notions of the debate, rather than saying, okay, markets are good, they can do many things, but we also need to protect ourselves. If we truly value families, we need to recognize that having a good wage and stability is important.
Didn't we go through all this in the early part of the 20th century? Didn't Upton Sinclair write about this, with the workers being mistreated and living in horrible conditions, and it was his books that caused that to shift in part, and the rise of labor unions? As all this has happened, as the middle class has become beleaguered, the power of the unions has also declined. It's never been popular here in the South, but around the country, the unions are they're not a factor anymore. That's another example of people, voting against their own self-interest?
Yeah, the decline in unions has had a chilling effect in terms of wage growth, and that even when people were not members, workers were not members of unions, they still benefited from what unions could accomplish.
We'll continue with that in a moment or two. Dr. Scott Fitzgerald, our guest, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and American Association of Blacks in Energy. Energize Charlotte, a forum about jobs in the oil, gas, and energy industry, this Thursday at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Details at aabe-hie energize.com. President Obama is stepping up U.S. efforts to treat Ebola victims and contain its spread in West Africa, addressing the medical, social, and political threats posed by the widening epidemic, the topic of the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Get up to date on the day's latest news by listening to All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE. It's your front row seat behind the headlines and offers a thorough and accurate account of what happened while you were at work. Make your commute home informative as well as entertaining with the most comprehensive news program on radio today. All Things Considered from NPR and WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Fitzgerald from UNC Charlotte. His book is called Middle Class Meltdown in America, Causes, Consequences, and Remedies. He's speaking at on Thursday at 6:30 at UNC Charlotte City Center, and it's open to the public. I want to share with you some emails before we go into more questions, and we get to some solutions to some of this. This have come in while we've been talking. Ken in McGrady emails, would your guest please comment about the change in population from 150 million after World War II to the present at about 320 million? How does this impact the job growth or available jobs plus automation versus population?
Well, clearly the increase in population will have an impact. However, at this part of that doesn't mean that there are fewer jobs to go around, because what happens as the population increases, they buy things. And by buying things, that increases firms' activities and producing things, which creates jobs. And so, again, sort of middle class, the middle class expenditures is what drives the economy. And so having a larger population means that there's more things that are needed, increased demand, which actually increases job opportunities.
Dennis in Mooresville emails, I recently read a detailed study of corporate behavior over the last 75 years. Statistics are astounding concerning what corporations do with their profits. Back in the 50s and 60s, 80% of their profits went to employee pay, capital investment, and new hiring. Today, most of that profit goes to repurchasing shares, executive bonuses, and shareholders. Does your guest agree that we are now an investor economy, and what does he suggest to fix it?
Well, I do agree, and Kevin and I have a chapter in the book discussing that. And so earlier when I was referencing that, the question is, what do we do with those profits in terms of how are those reinvested? And so we've definitely seen that shift, and they're not going to workers, and they're not necessarily even going into things that are going to increase the long-term health of a firm or job opportunities. In terms of solutions, I think that's a bit out of my realm of expertise.
In terms of that solution. Harden emails, aren't companies that take their employee base overseas to increase profits for shareholders and shelter their profits from taxes through inversions undercutting the ability of the U.S. economy to remain strong for the long term?
Yeah, the discussion of tax inversion and that has been really in the news quite frequently lately gets at some of these larger questions of practices that corporations will do that aren't illegal, but they will still are not doing things that are in the best interest of the workers or the middle class
or the United States.
Or the United States, precisely.
But should corporations, which are now people evidently, but should corporations necessarily have a political allegiance?
I don't think they should have a political allegiance in the sense of in terms of political parties. What I do think that
country.
To a country, yes. My perspective is that corporations should be rewarded for providing long-term stable employment. And we can do that in ways such as providing tax incentives for them to do that.
And I think you point out that we do not do that now.
That is correct.
We reward them for – the opposite is true.
That is precisely the case. Right? And so I think in terms of things that we can do to help strengthen the middle class, mm-hmm. is that we need to think very carefully about what we want our economy to look like and what corporations should and should not be rewarded for doing.
Tom emails, we can thank the great cowboy President Ronald Reagan for not having the brain power to see how he was being manipulated by corporate interests. What a mess. And one of the things that you do say is that trickle-down economics doesn't work. We believe it does. There are a whole bunch of people who shouted from the rafters.
We do. And it is, to me, it's one of the great puzzles of how an economic idea that had very little empirical base to begin with and has been repeatedly shown to not work has such staying power. And I do think it comes back to sort of these broader questions about ideology and political understandings and the ways in which particular ideas can tap into our understandings of how the system works and what the American dream is. And so if you believe that the American dream is alive and kicking, that there's equal opportunity for people to succeed and that I might be one of them, then when someone tells me that allowing further deregulation and increased concentration of wealth at the top is going to benefit everyone, I might be more willing to accept that, to buy into that. We also need to think about the incredible power of lobbyists and the political process itself. And so, for example, when the Dodd-Frank was amendment in 2010 was being debated, there were over 3,000 lobbyists hired to defeat it. That's more than five for every member of Congress. And so we are well aware that when the more loopholes there are in legislation, the more that firms are able to hire very intelligent, very high-powered, very well-paid teams of attorneys to find ways through those loopholes.
Let's get back to this marketing of an illusion, because you write about this in the book. You say, and this is a quote from the book, marketing of an illusion, the idea that deregulated markets, federal tax cuts, and the gutting of public infrastructure benefits everyone, including the middle class. You say the evidence supporting this claim was dubious, and the empirical evidence that exactly the opposite has happened is overwhelming. The federal government now exists as a vehicle for redistributing funds to the already prosperous. Tax burdens have shifted toward the middle class, and costs for many of the goods that the middle class consumes have been rising. Do you worry that making statements like that will get you attacked as a lefty? Because when Robert Reich talks about what he talks about, which is very much like what you talk about, Bill O'Reilly calls him a communist.
Right. And I think that is a symptom of a very problematic component of our society, which is we fall into these false dichotomies and ad hominem attacks and of name calling. And I think one of the things that Kevin and I have very intentionally done in our work over the years and is that this is not a political rant. This is trying to understand by gathering the best evidence we can about the interrelated factors of politics, economics, and society. And I think what we do in the book, and we have over 150 tables and graphs of trying to get these indicators, is to try to do a realistic, honest assessment of what's going on. And so there are different political trends within that. But I think the bigger question is that we need to find ways to have public discussions about economic inequality in ways that don't simply boil down to name-calling.
But who's going to do that? Because the politicians, as you say, we're in this politics of displacement at the moment you talk about in the book, where we talk about anything but money. And you've alluded to that in the conversation. Right. We talk about abortion. We talk about gay rights. We talk about gay marriage. We talk about anything but that to get people's left and right bases all riled up when our economic self-interest is continually voted against. So where is this discussion going to be held and who's going to hold it?
Well, I think it can be held in a couple of different places. And so as an educator, I think this won't come as a surprise, but I believe the classroom is a wonderful place for these sort of conversations to happen. And more broadly in terms of creating situations where people can explore ideas in ways that's not about defending your own position, but it's about learning from other things. It also, I think, is increasingly can take place within civic organizations. And it also it takes place in trying to really advocate for being thoughtful, engaged citizens and having those conversations rather than having an opinion on everything.
Do people who are struggling to pay their bills and working two jobs with two people working two jobs have the time to be thoughtful about things like this? So they're just trying to make ends meet.
Right. And I think that is a very good point. And so people like me have the privilege of being a scholar and an educator, and I get to do this full time.
But you're suspect because you are an intellectual. You've been diffused. You've been cut off at the knees.
I think the idea that being thoughtful and being intellectual is a bad thing is one that also prevents us from understanding sort of the broader complexities.
But isn't that deliberate?
I believe it is deliberate in terms of what part of it going back to the debates and the simplified views and the attacks is that there is very little space in terms of politics and media for those types of conversations.
Because you're dangerous. You say in the book, unfettered markets destroy jobs, families, and communities. Politicians complain about cultural decline while expanding the purview of the unfettered markets that perpetuated yet another round of tax cuts and privatizations occur, and still more complaints about the cultural decline follow. It's a self-perpetuating cycle, but that's a dangerous thing to point out.
I think it could be interpreted as a dangerous thing, and I think it might be surprising when we think about what the solutions to that might be, aren't as dangerous or as radical as they might sound.
Well, you say that individuals play a part in all of this by reducing credit and making wise use of it. In other words, part of your solution is for people to get smarter about their own personal economies. Avoid credit where you can. Use it only for the right reasons. You don't buy it. You don't rent a luxury item like a car. Don't lease a Lexus. Buy it if you can afford to buy it. And if you can't afford to buy it, buy something else. Start saving early when the time comes. Buy a house that you can afford. Well, that helps you deal with your own economic reality. It doesn't fix the problems that we've been talking about. So what must we do as a society?
I think there's at least three points that we need to seriously consider as we think about these collective responses. Because as you point out, the advice that we provide for individuals is in terms of for individual people, this is what you can do to help protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But that, again, is not going to look at the larger issue. And so part of it is that we need to have an honest assessment of what produced the vibrant middle class that we saw before growing levels of inequality, before stagnant wages. So what we talked about at the top of the program, the prosperous years, decades of the 50s and 60s were driven largely by accident rather than being a required part.
And is that recapturable? Because the world is different. It's a worldwide economy. We are not the biggest dog on the block and the only dog on the block. We are part of many.
Right. And I think in some ways it's not recapturable. But one of the things that we can do, and this is where the critique of unfettered markets comes in, is that we need to recognize that given the realities of a globalized economy, given the situation of firms struggling to survive, what we need to do is to find a way to reconnect capital accumulation with workers. And so what I mean by that is that rewarding firms for making choices that provide opportunities for stable employment, which will in fact then increase the economic activity of the middle class and bring that vibrancy back.
So if we rebuilt the middle class, which you advocate, finding ways to rebuild the middle class, what would it look like? Would it be the middle class of the 50s and 60s, or would it be a different new reality of a middle class?
Well, I think it would, in many ways, it would be a different new reality. And that we've seen changes in family structure, changes in the population, changes in terms of employment opportunity and equal employment opportunity for men and for women. So we'll see changes. So it's not an advocate. We're not advocating going back to sort of the 1950s Ozzie and Harriet type structure of families or economic arrangements in the U.S. But what it does is advocate for, it would be a middle class that was able to provide more energy in the community, to have more time to do other things, rather than simply struggle to make ends meet.
You say that we need to realize that good jobs and good wages are a family value. Wow. And that the government must provide national health care and a viable portable pension system. Let's talk about family values. How do you make that happen? Where you realize that good jobs and good wages build strong families, strong communities, and therefore that's a family value.
I think part of it is the broader political discussion and trying to change that discussion and shift that discussion of what are family values. And I think finding ways to say that it is not that if firms are going to be profitable, that they need to bring some of us with as employees, that they need to be providing this employment that is going to allow workers to be actively engaged in family life, in social life, in community.
If and there are companies that do that, and some of these high-tech companies do that, if the government provided national health care, and you're not talking about Obamacare, you're talking about something broader than the Affordable Care Act, taxes would have to rise. On whom would they have to raise those taxes?
Well, I think right now what we've seen is we've shifted our tax burdens from progressive tax systems to regressive. And I think there is a strong case to be made that those at the top should be paying a larger proportion of that. And I think more broadly, though, rather than getting into the specifics of the tax policy, I think more broadly we need to recognize that there will be an economic cost to trying to provide this form of stability for the middle class. And I think one of the things that we advocate is we think that cost is worth it.
You also point out that inequality is a social problem. Is that because those who have no stake in the society are trouble for the society?
I think that is part of it. I think also it means that if you are part of the elite, you are able to buy your way out of other social problems, and which limits the amount of interaction you have with the rest of society. And in a certain sense, sort of prevents this notion of there but for the grace of God, will I, that we recognize that we are in this together as a society.
Dr. Scott Fitzgerald, Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Sociology at UNC Charlotte, author of Middle Class Meltdown, Causes, Consequences, and Remedies. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production